First off, my first guest of the evening has written a book about New Zealand's French connections, especially in the 19th century and early 20th centuries. It's called New Zealand's France. The guest is Dr. Alistair Watts. He's on the line now. Kia ora, Alistair. Welcome tonight. Yes, it is Alistair, isn't it?
It is indeed. And leave the doctor out. It takes a bit of getting used to.
Yes, well, that's not my excuse for for getting the Alistair mixed up with the Andrew. Andrew's the name of my producer. Alistair, what drew you to this topic? Because you spent a lot of time in Asia, the former French colonies in Asia, or just Asia in general?
Asia in general, but Vietnam, of course. I was living there for 2 years, and I was asked while I was there if I'd ever been to Paris, and paradoxically, I hadn't. But somebody said to me, having lived here, you will understand more of it when you do get there. And that proved to be the case. When I got to China and was living there, of course, there was still in Shanghai the old colonial possessions, the French Quarter being one of the most notable. And I think that awakened in me a sense of the colonial heritage and particularly the footprint that the French had had compared to the British and other colonising nations.
How close did New Zealand come to being not New Zealand but Nouveau-Zéland?
Hindsight's a wonderful thing, and historians always benefit from it. I would have to say I don't think it came very close, but there was a period shortly after the early settlement and when the British first started negotiating or were negotiating with Maori, when it appeared likely that if a successful French colony could be established in the South Island, there was a good chance, as the French put it, if they become Catholic through the efforts of the missionaries, they will become French. So the possibility was there, although it faded fairly quickly after the treaty was signed.
Because French explorers were checking out there not long after Cook did, right?
They certainly were, and there was a series of visits which, for a variety of reasons, some were quite deliberate, looking, for example, whether this might be a suitable place to have a penal colony, and others were just simply exploring, much as the British were doing right throughout the South Pacific at the time. But there was enough of it to make the early British settlers, particularly from the 1820s onwards, suspect that the French had designs on New Zealand, and if they could, they would get their hands on it.
Who was the lead? Was it D'Urville, who was a leading French explorer?
Yes, indeed it was, and his landmarks are in the place names that we know now, and things like French's Pass and so forth, as well as the Channel and Islands and so on that we know. Perhaps it's important to also just to emphasise how critical whaling and whale oil was at the time. This, of course, the South Seas was an extremely important part of the European economy for extracting whale and whale-related products. So the prizes were more at that stage than just grabbing land.
And what presence was there in Aotearoa in terms of French whalers and sealers?
There was an extensive presence, actually, and surprisingly enough, they lived and worked alongside the British. One couldn't have said they were directly integrated, but they had their bases and they had their own operations, and they used New Zealand as a port for resupplying, dropping off stores and so forth as they went about their business. Indeed, it was intended when the first settlers were landed at Akaroa that the ships that dropped them off would carry on whaling in the South Pacific in order to partly, I guess, finance the operation of settlement.
How did it work, Alistair? Say you're around about the turn of the 19th centuries, early 1800s, and you want to set up a whaling base in the lower South Island. Do you deal at all with the colonial authorities in Australia, in New South Wales or Victoria, or do you deal directly with the iwi, or just try and stick a base there if there's nobody around to stop you?
I think it was a combination of the last two. I think there were certainly accommodations made, arrangements made with the iwi in the hope that they would, if not welcome you, at least leave you unmolested. And there was an exchange, of course, of goods, which we're quite familiar with, all the, you know, the muskets and the guns and so forth, as well as other modern, as it was seen at the time, goods. But it was as far as sovereignty went, with it taking 3 to 4 months for a letter to get either way from either Paris or London to New Zealand and back again, and the colonial governors in Australia being no more well informed about what was happening here than perhaps they were in London, there was, I guess, an element of lawlessness as far as the international situation went. And it was relied upon that people would follow the conventions, which were European conventions, I hasten to add, not the local ones that Maori might have expected to apply in such situations.
How wild then was the South? Was it like the Wild West, only wilder?
Well, that's an interesting debate. We hear a lot about the hell hole up at Russell and so forth. And there's a counter-argument that says it was probably not a hang of a lot worse than the situation that applied in a lot of seafaring towns in both France and the UK at the time. So I think it certainly had its wild elements, and the sailors were definitely looking for a bit of R&R when they got ashore. So I think in that aspect it was probably a little bit of the Wild West.
But just like the British, the French were establishing whaling and sealing bases in Aotearoa. And as you point out, whale oil, before we had oil from fossil fuel, that's how we got our oil, right?
Correct, yes. And before the mineral oils, that was an extremely important and valuable commodity to have, both for lighting as well as for heating.
You have already mentioned Akaroa, which is the obvious French settlement to bring up. When was that founded and by whom?
So that was founded in the 1840. It had originally was some land that had been acquired by a Frenchman who claimed that as part of his settlement he was entitled to a large chunk of the South Island. And the settlers, as the French saw it, were simply taking up the rights that he had already acquired from local iwi. Of course, what they didn't know, that Governor Hobson, after he had arrived and had his first appointment in New Zealand, put a red line through all of that and said he would not recognise any French claims to purchasing, as indeed he was not recognising a number of European, including British, claims to land purchasing, because I think he realised early on that this is where the trouble was going to start. As it happened, the French settlement wasn't successful from an economic point of view, and the small base of the original 60 settlers didn't turn into a major presence in New Zealand. But it was certainly enough for the New Zealand Company to see it as a threat and leverage it, with London to point out just what dastardly people the French were and all the woes that might befall the British as a colonising nation if they were allowed to succeed here.
Was the Treaty of Waitangi partly about keeping the French out from a British point of view?
In my view, it was, yes. It wasn't the whole story, and I always emphasise to folk when I'm speaking to them about this that I'm not a historian who claims to have a complete picture of all that happened, but I believe it was a strong influence. Both Governor Hobson and his immediate successor, Governor Fitzroy, were serving naval officers well within the memory of Trafalgar and the heroics of the British Navy. And, of course, they were firm believers that the power of the British Navy was what ruled the waves. So I think at the time of the treaty, there was certainly a fear raised in part, I would agree, by the New Zealand Company, that if the British didn't do something, the French would.
Akaroa remained a French, a quasi-French settlement, even if it didn't grow as much as those initial French settlers hoped it would?
Yes, it did. In part bolstered, I think, because of the efforts of the French Catholic mission in the north under Bishop Pompallier, who, of course, visited there and encouraged the settlers. And I think, against all logic and believed for a long period of time, that this could still be the foothold that France sought in this part of the world.
Were there any other settlements?
Nothing of significance happened. There was no follow-up settlement, and I think French attentions turned elsewhere in the Pacific, for instance, in Tahiti and so forth, where they saw more advantages in establishing bases, particularly in the days of sailing ships, where they could reprovision and so forth, whereas New Zealand was seen as a little bit remote and perhaps off the radar, so to speak, apart from the whaling and the exploitation of natural resources, as we've discussed.
But you have mentioned also the French Catholic Church, so maybe it's not just settlements, it's maybe missionaries.
Oh, absolutely. And this was a real danger, in inverted commas, as the Church of England missionaries and the Church Missionary Society saw it. The fear of the Catholicism of the French and what it might do to the Maori population were they become Catholic. And as I mentioned, I think both the British harboured the same suspicion as the French, that if there was wholesale conversions, that there was a very good chance that an affinity with France would arise. It was a major fear.
And how many French missionaries or French Catholics came to New Zealand? I mean, the one that comes to mind is Sister Aubert. I'm pretty sure she was from France, and her settling down in the Whanganui River Valley at Jerusalem.
Yes, indeed. It's not a topic that I've looked at in detail, but there were spasmodic arrivals of different religious figures over the years, particularly in the priesthood and, as you mentioned, in the religious orders as well, who attempted and largely successfully left their landmark in places such as, you know, we're aware of the Maris Brothers and Mission Vineyards and so forth over in Hawke's Bay. So those signs are still there of their attempts to establish a presence. I think Mother Aubert largely became part of the New Zealand landscape, and although she was identifiably French, as much as anything she assimilated into the local situation and the cultural values that were here, and it was trying to work within that environment rather than trying to make Maori and local European settlers Catholic that to make them French rather than Catholic that dominated her efforts.
Because it's interesting, I grew up in a family of lapsed Anglicans, right? But my father still had a bit of that anti-Catholic bias. Whether it's because he was a born-again atheist, I don't think that's the entire reason. And I always assumed that was more against Irish Catholicism. But I'm wondering now whether maybe we were also, the Anglicans feared the Catholics because they were also French.
I think that was the case. And certainly some of that sectarian divide from Ireland made its way to New Zealand. And many of the New Zealand Catholic priests were of Irish direct settlers from Ireland, or indeed were of Irish extraction themselves. That, I think, kept the pot bubbling, as indeed did all the newspaper reports that were faithfully reprinted from the British press that continued to emphasise the chaos and disorder in mainland France and just what a threat it would be if the French were to succeed, not only in New Zealand but anywhere else in the world as well, with their mission, as the British saw it, to impose a Catholicism upon the rest of the world.
So how did the colonies of Australia and New Zealand view the French colonies in the tropical Pacific, Tahiti and New Caledonia?
It was largely by comparison, the age-old argument that we hear, better off under the British than under the French. And the newspapers, particularly titles such as the Southern Cross, as it was then, out of Auckland, did an awful lot to emphasise what they saw as the downside of French colonisations. The British ambition was to have self-funding and self-governing settlements that were demonstrably British, whereas the French model was very much one of a metropolitan France that extended geographically across the Pacific. This, of course, was the big fear, and this was the one that evoked the most emotive responses from both many of the newspapers, but also from the British colonial authorities.
How much of that anti-French attitude persisted into the 20th century, do you think, Alistair? I mean, by the time, because later on in the 19th, it becomes clear that there's no way France is going to take over New Zealand. Unfortunately for the Maori, the British had done that. Maybe it would have been the same with it being the French, just different characters and different wars. But the French were no longer rivals against the British for New Zealand. But yet, did the anti-French attitude remain, Alistair, among the settlers, the white settlers?
I believe it did. I think that early perception that had been stirred up was kept bubbling in the pot, so to speak. One of the things I did was look back at the old newspapers, and I drew a random sample of articles from them, looking at any articles that mentioned or topics that mentioned France and the French. And what I found was that most of those were adverse and direct reprints out of the British press. This was a time from the 1860s right through to the start of the First World War when France was viewed by the British as if Napoleon and the Revolution and all the discord, disquiet and disruption that had been going on in the earlier period was still persisting. And every effort was made to paint the French as a disordered people who were suffering in some way from some sort of malady that made them totally unsuitable to be citizens of the world, let alone fit to rule their own country.
So what happened in 1914, Alistair, when suddenly the French are on our side?
This was a major problem. The whole thing had to be put into reverse. Immediately before the outbreak of the First World War, there were two incidents that really stand out to me. One was the Dreyfus incident. Dreyfus was a Jewish Frenchman who came from the Alsace area of France, which borders onto Germany, and he was accused, probably falsely as it turns out, of being a spy for the French. As it happened, the matter eventually got resolved, but it was written up in the British newspapers as if this was the most dastardly thing that had happened in recent memory. There were also confrontations between the French and the British in Africa, and again, those things that really had nothing to do with New Zealand were written up as if they were of immediate consequence for New Zealand's prospects. So all this negative sentiment had to be reversed as we went into World War One. It was cunningly done. The French and the British navies met. They had a regatta. They visited Brest. They visited Plymouth, the port of Plymouth in the United Kingdom. There were many photographs and newspapers such as the Daily Mirror and so forth showing the French and British sailors together. And all of a sudden, the lights were on and we're all great friends. And Germany was now the enemy.
See, it's interesting, Alistair, because I've had Damien Fenton on, a military historian, for many years, and we began discussing through the centenary years of the First World War, 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, the First World War. And one of the things that Damien quickly challenged with me was my inherent bias in terms of seeing the First World War as a complete waste, like it was pointless. What was it about? Why were we doing it? And that, Damien reminded me, this is a New Zealand and British viewpoint, perhaps. For France, this was a war of survival. They were under attack. They were being invaded. And the suffering, the loss of life by the French was tremendous in that First World War. And it wasn't until Damien came on nights and talked to me about this that I really appreciated that.
Yes, and I think flowing on from that, you can see that the British saw that there's colonies around the world that they had established who had a duty to support the British in seeing off this dastardly threat to the French. Arguably, the British wanted to see neither the French nor Germany dominate Europe, and it was in their interests to make sure that France survived rather than having another nation state under the control of the Germans, much as they had anticipated might have happened, or did indeed happen, under Napoleon. Recreated, if you like, another European Union under a different name. And for those reasons, they saw that supporting France was a matter of life and death for them, and equally that it was important for New Zealand, who had staked all, both economically and arguably culturally, at least amongst the European folk here, of being seen and supported by Britain. So it was a two-way street.
And do we still suffer from a bit of anti-French bias now, Alistair?
I don't think you have to create an itch too much to get scratching at it. I think from time to time things, certainly the Rainbow Warrior was a dramatic.
Yeah, Dominique Pierre and Alain Maffard, they got us itching again, didn't they?
They sure did. And this, I guess, goes to the core of one of the themes in my book, that this whole idea that othering, you know, it's the others, it's them, that you can classify or group whole races of people or ethnicities based on the actions of a few and take that as typical of all of them. So it doesn't take much to mention France and French in one breath, and these are the sorts of things that come up. Before that, of course, it was the European Union and the fact that France was leaving, was taking Britain away.
Yes, it was their fault.
And
of course
it was.
They were the worst farmers. The British weren't. It was somehow, they were all right. But the French were the real bad guys.
Of course they were. They could make butter and, goodness me, they could grow beef and wool.
How dare they?
And even worse, it was only 23 miles across the English Channel. My goodness, you know, what has this got to do with us? You know, we've been good and faithful servants. We've fought for both countries, arguably, both for France and Britain, and we're going to be treated like this. Of course, the French did try to establish trading ties directly with New Zealand after the First World War, but New Zealand didn't want anything to do with that. No, we were going to look after Britain, and our future was firmly tied to them, no matter what economic logic might have suggested.
Alistair, you've got 90 seconds for this, and this is a bit of a general question to throw at you late in the day, but do you sometimes think, because we're pretty we mostly speak English in this country, and that blinds us to a whole lot of different ideas that don't come from the English-speaking world?
I think it does. I think we still, without really thinking about it, see a flag that's got the Union Jack on it. I still don't think we think about too much about the predominant language or where it came from. I think we accept place names like Nelson and Wellington without really thinking about it. I think most of our towns have got a name with a street like Waterloo Street or something to do with Picton or names of that nature, and they're all relics of France. So I think these things get ingrained, and without really thinking about it, we just accept them as part of our heritage.
Alistair, lovely to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.